Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. News about prostate cancer was in the headlines last week on the most personal and public health fronts. On Monday, radio personality Don Imus had some news to share.
So I'm changing the name of the Imus Cattle Ranch for Kids with Cancer to the Imus Cattle Ranch for Kids with Cancer and Me, because last Wednesday, I was diagnosed with stage 2 prostate cancer.
Then Wednesday, results of two major new studies on prostate cancer and screening were out, raising new questions about testing and treatment. Big studies of 76,000 men in the U.S., of 182,000 in Europe, raising big issues on life and death and quality of life for millions of men. This hour on Point, tough decisions for men and their families when it comes to prostate cancer. You can join the conversation. Are you with Imus, diagnosed with prostate cancer? Have you gone for the full treatment or hung back? Why? We'll begin with a closer look at what the two new studies say and don't say. Dr. Gerald Andriol is chief urologic surgeon at Washington University School of Medicine and Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis. He led the U.S. study of 76,000 men. He joins us from Berlin, where we caught up with him. Welcome to On Point, Dr. Andriol.
Tom, thank you for having me.
So I've read many interpretations of what these studies say. Here, the Los Angeles Times says, now two major long-awaited studies show that screening men for prostate cancer provides little or no benefit in saving lives and can lead to painful, debilitating, and expensive medical treatments without any obvious benefit. Is that how you would summarize these, Doctor?
Well, I guess that may be the headline, and I would say there's probably a little more nuance to that. But the basic point is that, screening healthy men for prostate cancer has a relatively modest reduction in overall prostate cancer mortality. And there's no question it comes at a fairly high price, both in human and economic terms. So the equation is not so easy to interpret to say, yes, get screened, or no, don't get screened. But it gives us the data and the information we need to talk candidly with our patients.
Both of these studies published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Tell us more about your findings in the American study and how they compare to the European study, Doctor.
Well, in our study in the United States, we screened men every year for 6 years with the PSA test, and with 4 years with the digital rectal examination. Now, we followed all of our patients for 7 years and about two-thirds of our patients for 10 years. And at this point in time, we do not see any improved overall mortality in the group of men who got screening in comparison to the men who did not get screening.
PSA is prostate-specific antigen test. This is a blood test that looks for specific antigens that cancer in the prostate would produce?
Well, this is the prostate-specific antigen, or PSA test, is prostate-specific. It is not prostate cancer-specific.
Right.
And therein lies the dilemma. Many men who have enlarging prostates or inflammation in their prostate can have elevations of their PSA and not have prostate cancer.
So what,
and that finding often results in biopsies and stress and anxiety, as you might imagine.
So you're saying, it's not that the test itself is particularly invasive or even, I guess, particularly expensive, but it's the reaction once the screening is done. What happens?
That's exactly right, Tom. It's all of the downstream consequences of getting a PSA. You know, if it's elevated, we often will end up doing a biopsy of the prostate,
okay.
you know, which is an intrusive procedure.
Right.
And we find a lot of prostate cancers when we do these biopsies. And the data show that we find, 70 to 80% more prostate cancers among these men. And we know a priori that only a small fraction of them, probably one out of every 10 or so, are destined to die of the prostate cancer that we find.
Because it's so slow growing that most would die from other or natural causes before it ever threatened their lives.
For many men with prostate cancers, they have small, slow-growing tumors, and they'll die of other things before they die of this cancer.
Nevertheless, when you say, you know, we'd go in, we'd biopsy, we'd find cancer. I mean, to most people who haven't been through this, that would sound like a good thing. If you have cancer, find it.
Yeah, it is, and it is very helpful for patients and doctors to know if a given man has prostate cancer. Unhappily, we have recently had almost a knee-jerk reaction to say, okay, you have cancer, let's do something about it. And that's a very natural reaction for both doctors and patients. But we now know that when we do that, we end up over-treating quite a large number of men.
What's the downside in that let's do something response, that over-treatment, as you describe it?
Well, the human costs are substantial. You know, some men who undergo surgery or radiation will be afflicted with urinary incontinence and sexual dysfunction and occasionally even other adverse lifelong side effects. So it's not a trivial thing to say, oh, you have cancer, let's get it out or let's give you some radiation, because men might be living with those consequences for quite a long time for a cancer that was destined never to kill them.
How common is urinary incontinence? That sounds like a big drag. Or sexual dysfunction, impotence. How commonly does that emerge after these treatments?
Well, it's temporary in quite a large number of men, certainly the vast majority. Long-term incontinence or leakage that lasts more than a year probably occurs in somewhere from 10 to 30% of the patients who have various radiation and or surgical procedures for their prostate.
And is sexual problems impotence?
Sexual problems, again, are virtually ubiquitous immediately after surgery, and they often get better after surgery, but there's still a third to a half of the men who will have persistent long-term sexual dysfunction.
Now, what about the big European study? They had 100 and I don't know how many, huge study, and it's being presented as slightly more favorable towards screening and treatment. Is that right?
Well, their study is bigger, and they had the opportunity to follow more patients for a slightly longer period of time, and now they show that there's about a 20% reduction in prostate cancer mortality. Now, I should say, when their study was as old as ours in the U.S., they did not see a mortality benefit either. And it's only just now beginning to appear that they have been following a larger number of men for a longer period of time.
Doctor, let's begin to go to our listeners, because they have their own experiences. It's not the same as being 76,000 people tested or 180,000, but nevertheless, Michael's calling from Central Village, Connecticut. Michael, you're on the air with the man who was right out front on these studies. What's your experience?
Well, I know there's a lot of controversy about the PSA test. I just want to give my own experiences with it. I had a PSA test quarterly. That's four times a year.
That's a lot. Did they think you were at special risk, Michael?
No, it just happened that I had a cholesterol problem. So
okay.
My general practitioner, when I saw him quarterly for mm-hmm. the cholesterol, added the PSA test.
Okay.
And in August of 2006, at the age of 59, my PSA was normal. But in the next quarterly test, in December 2006, my PSA was 12, which is very high.
Okay.
A subsequent biopsy in my urologist office determined that I had stage 3 prostate cancer,
mm-hmm.
for which I was subsequently treated with radiation. Now, in one sense, the PSA test did not work, But on the other hand, it may have saved my life.
And what about the side effects, the quality of life issues, Michael? Were they a big deal for you or not?
I've led a mostly normal life. I was given radiotherapy with a combined hormone treatment called Lupron. I can say romantic life is somewhat curtailed, but I am now 60 years old.
So you're alive and feeling happy for that. Dr. Andriol, what do you say to Michael's story?
Well, you know, it's not that atypical, and I really wish Michael the best. And, of course, we need to watch your PSA regularly over the next several years to make sure that all the cancer cells were killed by the radiation. But I think it underscores a crucial point, Tom, and that is that, you know, men like Michael who are very diligent and follow every direction they're given in terms of having a PSA and a rectal exam, you know, may nonetheless be found to have a cancer that's already partially gotten out of the prostate, just as his did, if he's classifying it as stage three. So the test is not perfect. And remember, in the European study, it reduces a man's chance of dying by 20%. It does not reduce his chances of dying by 100%.
But, Michael, but your study is sort of suggesting what? That screening is not necessary? We shouldn't do so much? But Michael's feeling like it may have saved his life to have done it.
Well, it may have. We you know what? We don't know yet. It sounds like it's only a year or two, and I sincerely hope it is beneficial for him. But we just don't know at this point for him as an individual. And I might say, you know, when we do these studies of 76,000 patients, we're looking at a whole population. And among the population of men who get screened, there will be winners and there will be losers. You know, men who have aggressive cancers discovered that we know we cure, there will be other men who have indolent, slow-growing cancers that we treat and inflict incontinence and other side effects, and that guy is clearly a loser. So it's the balance of the winners and the losers on the screening arm and in the control arm that we're trying to report on in these very large trials.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big issue right now in men's health, new research and controversy over testing and treating for prostate cancer. Two big studies out last week in the New England Journal of Medicine, a huge American study, a huge European study, with new insights on the value of screening and its efficacy for saving lives. We've been joined from Berlin, Germany, by Dr. Gerald Andriol, Chief Urologic Surgeon at Washington University School of Medicine at Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis. He led the U.S. study, the National Cancer Institute study of 76,000 men. We're joined as well right now from Cleveland by Dr. Stephen Jones, Chairman of the Department of Regional Urology at the Glickman Urological Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Jones, thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Dr. Andriol, I want to just get your bottom line here and then Stephen Jones' response to it. What are you saying to men, that they should not be screened for prostate cancer, or if they're screened, they should set the results aside? What's the takeaway for our listeners, Dr. Andriol?
Well, here's the way I would kind of summarize it. And I must say, put a little asterisk on this.
Okay.
It's hard to summarize, you know, 15 years of research and 200,000 patients in a couple of sound bites. But I might say the following. You know, we don't see a mortality benefit for screening among men who are destined to live only 7 to 10 years. And the corollary of that is, you know what, if the man in front of me in the office next week is old, he's sick, it looks to me like his diabetes and his smoking history are going to catch up with him sometime in the next decade, I don't think he needs to have a PSA test. Now, for all other men, for younger men, particularly for the youngest men who have a strong family history of prostate cancer, I think we should continue to get the PSA test. But I think we should have a more measured reaction to abnormal PSA tests. And I think we can proceed with biopsies in a lot of men, but I think we should be very judicious about which men actually get treatment.
Dr. Jones, at the Cleveland Clinic, there's a bottom line, you know, of necessity edited down from a huge study and a lot of thinking. You're a practitioner. What do you make of it, sir?
Well, first, I think you have to understand the efforts that went behind these studies are just fantastic. For the researchers to show the diligence to get these data is really an overwhelming task. Fortunately, we now have good evidence that screening, we have evidence of two things. One is that screening does appear to have some impact on mortality, but certainly not in the short term. And I think Dr. Andrill's position of taking a more measured response, both to the PSA and then probably even as importantly, once cancer is diagnosed, to again step back and make a determination on the individual patient, is this man really going to be made better by aggressive therapy, or should less aggressive or maybe even no therapy be used on an individual basis?
We've got an email here from listener Sharon who says, you know, statistics are fine except when it's you. She says it saved, PSA test saved her father's life. She says get screened, get biopsies if necessary, and take action. But Dr. Andrill seems to be putting a little caution on that. What do you say, Dr. Jones?
I think the point here is that for any individual patient, if they had a PSA and they had a good outcome, it's easy to draw the conclusion that the PSA was responsible for that outcome. I think we have to step back and recognize that some of the men who had a PSA and were found to have cancer might have had a good outcome even without the PSA. These studies, I think, demonstrate that very well.
And if there's if a PSA test comes back and it indicates that there's a problem, how exactly do you go about deciding what a more measured reaction would be? I mean, what does that mean when you're sitting there talking with a patient? You've got this huge study results in your hand, in the back of your mind. So does the patient now. But what does more measured mean?
Well, initially, to look at the individual patient, as Dr. Andrill mentioned, if the patient is elderly and has a less than 10-year life expectancy, it's unlikely that anything that you do will improve upon that person's eventual outcome. And frankly, of course, anything you do might actually worsen things if they undergo treatments that had the side effects that he mentioned. So for a patient who is healthier and younger, one step might be simply to repeat the PSA to be sure that it truly is, quote, abnormal. Another might be to put that in perspective of his own personal situation, because we know that men with a very, very large prostate called BPH, those men may have an elevated PSA simply by the fact that that large prostate produces a lot of PSA. Unfortunately, there's no cutoff, no point at where we can say it's normal or abnormal. And so it becomes a very complex discussion for each time that goes around. And that's why this remains so controversial. We'd like to be able to, with any individual patient, speak for 30 minutes about all the implications. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, that's just not the reality. So we're faced with an abnormal finding, and in short order, the patient and physician have to make a decision together.
Let's get a call from Pocatello, Idaho, and Jerry. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air with Cleveland and Berlin. We got the whole world here. What do you know, Jerry?
Hey, Tom. About 3 years ago, I'm 55. Mm-hmm. I was having regular prostate screening and exams by my doctor, but I had a different problem that my physician ordered an MRI for. And my PSA tests, by the way, were all coming back normal. So were the manual exams. But when I went in for the MRI, the tech noticed two dark spots, just happened to notice two dark spots in the area of the prostate. So sent the pictures to my doctor, who sent me to a urologist. And he did a biopsy. And I, too, was diagnosed with stage 3 prostate cancer, ended up having brachytherapy, and everything seems to be fine now. My PSA tests are way below normal. Before the diagnosis, they were at 1, and now they're down around 0.2, 0.3, which indicates everything seems to be doing well. But had I relied only on the results of the PSA tests, if it hadn't have been for a tech noticing those spots on that MRI, I may not have been able to catch it in time.
So you had more than the regular screening and got it caught right there. Jerry, thanks very much for that. Let us hold that thought and get one more call right here from Boston. And Lewis. Lewis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 63 years old, and about a year and a half ago, I was diagnosed with very early stage prostate cancer, and I spent almost 6 months agonizing over what kind of treatment to have or whether to have any treatment. And what I found was that the language that's used in the research about just how awful the side effects of almost all kinds of treatment are is very cagey. And it's very, and
what do you mean, Lewis? Say it plain for us. What do you mean exactly here?
That most men who have radiation or surgery end up impotent.
Mm-hmm.
He said 50%.
Yeah.
He made it sound, he said mostly.
Dr. Andriol said a third or a half may end up with problems there. Yeah, yeah. But it looks too cagey to you, not straightforward enough about the costs of this?
That's right. Absolutely.
Dr. Andriol, what do you say to Lewis here? He, you know, you must have seen many men agonize over this, doctor.
Oh, I empathize a lot with Lewis because it's very, very difficult for people to interpret the statistics that we doctors often barrage the patients with. We got to realize these are men who probably have been healthy for a large part of their life. They're sick kind of for the first time, and they're dealing with that on an emotional level. And then we have a fusillade of figures about your chance of dying, your chance of having curable disease, your chance of needing hormones, and this and that and the other thing. It must be overwhelming. If I could, Tom, I'd just like to amplify a couple of points that Dr. Jones made, because I think they're right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we need to have better tools to predict what's going to happen to the man who has prostate cancer in terms of his other health issues. But equally important, we need much better tools to define whether he has an aggressive tool. An aggressive tumor or
mm-hmm,
not.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we rely on biopsy information, which is a little bit haphazard. What we need are really good genetic markers that we have to understand the abnormal genes that produce these cancers and correlate outcomes in men who have cancers with certain genes turned on and certain genes turned off. That, I think, is the future. That's what we're talking about in general with the concept of personalized medicine. And if we could apply that to prostate cancer, we wouldn't need to have all the agonizing and our heavy breathing that we're going through right now.
Let's pray for that. Lewis, if I may ask you, what did you decide in the end? Having stared the potential lifestyle consequences in the face, what'd you do?
Well, I had seen the consequences of surgery in a friend of mine, and they were awful. I ended up talking to a urologist, a radiologist, and an oncologist, mm-hmm. and a nurse oncologist, and eventually decided to do what's called wait and watch, which is regular PSA tests,
right,
and a biopsy once a year.
Mm-hmm. And so far, you're hanging in with that.
Yes.
Boy, you can just hear the pressure in that, though. That's not fun. But then, if it's there, it's there.
Well, it's not. It's a treatment that's not for everyone. And it took me a while to calm down enough to be able to actually look at the statistics and figure out what they mean and realize that with a very this is so often a very slow growing kind of cancer that the odds are that if there's any change for the worse, that it will be caught.
Lewis, good luck with that, and thank you for sharing that story. I think it helps a lot of other people to hear these. Dr. Andriol in Berlin, I know we have to let you go, but the study goes on. When and what might we hear next from it?
Well, Tom, we need to wait longer because, remember, at this point, only a tiny fraction of the men have died of prostate cancer, and far fewer than 50% have died of anything. So we plan to follow this cohort of patients for another 5 years or so. And as more men die, that sounds bad, but as more men die, we think we'll get an even better understanding of the good and the bad parts of PSA screening.
Dr. Gerald Andriol, who led the U.S. study of 76,000 men for the National Cancer Institute on prostate cancer screening and treatment. Dr. Andriol, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks to your listeners.
Dr. Jones, how about our caller, Lewis? And you heard earlier, we heard from Pocatello, Idaho. You're listening to these cases. What are they telling you?
I think the point that Dr. Andrew made there actually was very, very important, that very few men die of prostate cancer, almost no matter what. And I think that when men have the diagnosis, the first thing I want them to understand is that you're probably going to be okay. So obviously it's those ones who are at risk of something bad happening that we want to identify, whether it be genetics, whether it be with biopsy strategies, which right now are frankly the best that we have. We don't want to step back away from the fact that men do very well over time. Lewis actually, I think, is a great example of, he explored all his options, really put a lot of thought into it, and I admire people for doing that. And that in his circumstance, it looks like his risk of dying of prostate cancer was lower than his risk of side effects from treatment. So he's taken an active approach, and the term we would use there is active surveillance, and that is sometimes termed watchful waiting. I think active surveillance is really what he's doing, is he's got a physician watching that very carefully, and if there's any signs of trouble, then of worsening, then at minimum he can at that point address it. And that most studies would suggest that even if there's a delay before treatment, at the point that that disease declares itself as being bad, treatment still has a very good chance of success, and at that point you know those side effects were worth having undergone.
I want to welcome into our conversation now from Wilmington, North Carolina, Dr. Norton Hadler, professor of medicine and microbiology and immunology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, longtime watchdog in his own profession, author of Worried Sick, A Prescription for Health in an Overtreated America. Dr. Hadler, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation, Tom.
You've been sort of shaking the bars for a long time here about too much screening and too much medicalization of American health. Do you see more support for your position in these studies that have just come out on prostate screening?
Well, these studies are reiterating the kinds of information we've had for a decade. They may be doing it a bit better, but we've known the story pretty well for a decade. And we are continuing to make it very hard for everybody to be able to understand it by the way we teach it. It's much simpler set of issues than even the journalists are able to bring forward. It's very simple. All men are going to die, and all men over the age of 60 have prostate cancer. And what we'd like to be able to say is we can identify those men who will die from their prostate cancer and distinguish them from those who will die with their prostate cancer. And PSA is a screening test that we hoped would do that, and it won't. It simply won't do that for us. We need a totally different test. And the reason it won't do it for us goes something like this, and these studies actually illustrate this again. I need to screen 1,000 men for 10 years to find one that is going to die of prostate cancer. And if I'm going to screen with PSA, for every one in 10 years in 1,000, I will treat 50 who will die with their prostate cancer, not from it, but I will have already removed their prostate.
Mm.
So when somebody says, gee, thanks, I'm a survivor, they may be a survivor, but there's a 50-to-1 chance that they are a survivor of the procedure and not of the cancer.
Does that mean you would throw away the screening and say, you know, good luck, men?
These are, good luck, men is not a bad notion, but these are personal choices in our country. I won't let you check my PSA, and the reason is that it's not simply a blood test. First of all, it goes up and down spontaneously and depending on activity. Second of all, if it's up, they're going to stick needles into my prostate. And there's a pretty good chance they're going to find a little prostate cancer, and very few of us can sleep at night. Once we've been told, we have prostate cancer, we're going to watch it. I'd rather not know, because I don't want you to remove my prostate, because it's highly unlikely that removing the prostate will change my date of death.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big issue right now in men's health, new research and controversy over testing and treatment for prostate cancer. We heard earlier in the hour from the lead of a big U.S. study out from the National Cancer Institute, big long-term study with kind of head-turning headlines coming out of it. We're joined by Dr. Stephen Jones. He's chairman of the Department of Regional Urology at the Glickman Urological Institute at the Cleveland Clinic, with us today from Cleveland. And from Wilmington, North Carolina, by Dr. Norton Hadler, professor of medicine in microbiology and immunology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, author of Worried Sick. Dr. Jones, I want to come straight to you. Just before the break, you heard Dr. Hadler saying we're an over-medicalized nation. You know, essentially there's a high yield of grief and a minimal yield of specific disease mortality with prostate treating wreaks havoc on quality of life. He says, for him at least, better not to know. What do you say?
Well, Tom, Dr. Hadler brought up an interesting concept that, in fact, he stated we already know that everyone over the age of 60 has prostate cancer. And that's really not completely accurate, although it's not too far from the absolute truth. We know that as we age, that we will develop low levels of low-grade prostate cancer in very large numbers of men. And the way we know that is when men die of other causes and undergo an autopsy and they're checked, we find cancer in a very, very common, in a very age-related manner. By the time you're in your 60s, there's probably well over 50% chance, but that wouldn't be a 100% chance. That what we really want to know about these men is not do they have prostate cancer, but do they have prostate cancer that will hurt them? And so we want to separate the concepts of you've got it versus you've got it and it's a problem. And one of the problems in our society is I think everyone in the conversation recognizes we link those two together. You have cancer, you've got a problem, because cancer is a problematic word. And that our hope would be that until we find better ways to not find it at all, if you will, is that we find the things, whether they be grade or, as Dr. Andrew Ohl said, genetic or molecular markers that may really, really tell us what's going to happen with that patient, and try to separate so that if a patient has life-threatening disease, in other words, we still know that prostate cancer is the most common cause of cancer death in men. That's a fact we can't escape from. Mm. So does screening change that? Not as much as we would like, and I think everyone in the conversation is comfortable with that as well. But our hope is to find the cancers that are important and deal with them and recognize that the other ones perhaps can be watched. As Lewis said earlier, that's really probably the best that we can hope for right now.
Dr. Hadler, what about it? Don't want to mess around with you without reason, but if it's life-threatening, maybe there's a need for intervention.
Oh, no doubt. But it's not the discussion. The discussion we're having is different. The discussion is whether PSA screening will find the evil prostate cancer in time so that I care. If I have an evil prostate cancer and I die of a stroke at some ripe old age, I really don't care how many diseases I had that day. So there's nothing inherently wrong with screening as a notion. But it is a demanding exercise. You need a test that is accurate, and I agree with Dr. Jones, we don't have one yet, and we all are waiting for one for prostate cancer. We need a disease that is meaningful to me as a person that you're looking for, which is not prostate cancer. It's prostate cancer that's going to kill me before my time, and then you need something to do about it that will help me. Well, we have something to do about it. We have these aggressive interventions that essentially remove the prostate with all of the attendant complications we're talking about. But because it's aggressive intervention, it's not a sugar pill, and because it will give you a disease in high likelihood, incontinence is a disease for about half the men who are rendered impotent. It is a disease for which they have to take additional medicines. That trade-off right now is such that we don't have a good enough test. We don't have a screening test for important prostate cancer, and we don't want to remove everybody's prostate because we will make far more disease by doing that than the prostate cancer is likely to make for the individual person.
So given current realities, I mean, PSA screening is what we have, as I understand all of you today. It's what we have. You say it's inadequate, but if it's what we have, then I guess you said before the break, better not to know.
You don't want to know unless you're going to do something about it. So this notion about, we'll just screen anyhow is kind of a fatuous notion. It's better not to know if you're not going to do anything about it, or you shouldn't do anything about it, or you can't do anything about it that's important. So the answer is, in our climate today, with a discussion like this, I can't tell people they shouldn't have PSA screens. I can tell people that they shouldn't have PSA screening without almost signing an informed consent, that they realize that there's a high likelihood that they're going to acquire a label, you may have prostate cancer, that we have data that acquiring that label is not fun. Men worry when they have that label, that the only way to lay the issue to rest is to essentially remove your prostate, which has a lot of attendant morbidity, and 50 times for every one, it's a useless thing to do. It's not going to lay anything to rest. So if you're still willing to have PSA screening knowing this, fine. But don't for 1 minute assume that this is actually the kind of test that we all ought to line up for. This is a very dicey marginal test, and there are several others like it that we have that have become part of our culture that are not doing what most people think they should be doing.
Dr. Jones, it's easy to imagine thousands of men listening to Dr. Hadler and saying to themselves, well, you know, maybe I will just skip the PSA test next time. Maybe it is better not to know. He's making it, you know, a serious case. If we take it seriously, what do you say to it, Dr. Jones?
I think it goes back to Lewis's experience earlier that he found out there was cancer there. He explored it and found that his cancer was not life-threatening, apparently, at least from what we know about his case. And so he made a very wise choice, quote, not to do anything about it. And it's really not that he's not doing anything about it. It's that he is actively watching it for a worsening. In contrast, had he been found to have a very serious cancer, then he would have made a very different decision. And the problem is that at the time of screening, all we know is that it can find whether there's cancer there or not. We have to take it to the next level and make the decision. Is it a serious cancer? And if so, Lewis or almost anyone in that circumstance would have said, absolutely, I understand that there are potential complications, but this is a disease that is life-threatening to me, and I want to put a stop to it. So it's not an automatic decision to not or to do something, but to have the information to be able to make that decision. In addition, it's not that everyone undergoes radical prostatectomy. Many men undergo radiation, which has its own side effects, but typically a little bit easier on the patient. An emerging concept is focal therapy, in which we would treat only part of the cancer. And it's a very new emerging concept. But in very carefully chosen men with early cancers, we now would treat just the area of the cancer, thereby minimizing the effects on the rest of both the prostate and, of course, the associated structures that might be related to side effects. Mm.
Let's hear from our listeners and their experience from Christiansburg, Virginia. Charlie, you're on the air, Charlie. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Mine's a little bit different spin. I was, all of a sudden, I had trouble urinating.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to my doctor, and he says, well, I think we should run a test here. So they run a test on my PSA.
Okay.
And it was 3 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I went back 2 months later, and it was 7.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through all the tests, went to I don't know how many doctors I went to, but they finally found that I had 90% cancer in my prostate.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so enlarged that I couldn't urinate.
Mm-hmm.
And they removed it in January. And
you mean like just a couple of months ago, Charlie?
Yes. In January 20th, it was removed.
Okay.
And I have never felt better. I have never urinated better in the last year and a half than I have now. And I feel so much better. And they told me it was because of the cancer. They also found infected pocket beside my prostate.
Right.
Keeping it swollen.
Did they take your prostate out entirely, Charlie?
Yes, it took it out completely.
And you're feeling good, a lot better. What about sexual side effects?
Well, I haven't started that yet because I'm going through...
Kind of tender.
Taking all the medicine.
Right.
But my leakage has gone down by the day.
Dr. Hadler, what do you say to Charlie's testimony there?
Well, Charlie is talking about
what's called prostatism, difficulty urinating because of something about the anatomy of the prostate. So some of his relief, you know, we have expert urological surgeons such as Dr. Jones who mm-hmm. deal with this kind of prostatism. It's almost the second set of discussions. But in terms of saving lives, that's why we have these two enormous studies. The U.S. study with randomizing almost 80,000 some odd men to active screening versus whatever the community was doing, and the Europeans have done it to twice that number they've randomized, and it's very hard to imagine that they're saving any lives. In America, they can't show it, and the numbers I just gave you before, following 1,000 men for 10 years mm-hmm. to maybe save one life, and having to do surgery unnecessarily in 50 other men in that period of time, is the best case data.
Dr. Jones,
to which I say we're not doing what we think we're doing with the screening. Now, that doesn't mean mm-hmm. that you don't do diagnostic tests. Charlie had a problem he went to the doctor with. The urologist came up with a solution to his problem.
Dr. Jones, Charlie sounds pretty happy that he went in, you know, followed the testing, had something done about it. Does that, Dr. Hadler says, well, maybe that doesn't speak to what we're talking about here. This was a comfort issue, not a mortality issue.
Well, first, I'm happy that he's had a good outcome. It sounds like he's been yeah. worked up appropriately, and we can always be happy about that. Indeed, this is really not a screening scenario, but it's testament to prostate cancer can cause problems, and so we have to take that as part of the decision-making. When we look at the concept of whether this is the best-case scenario, it's really probably not, in that we know that actually about half of the men in one of the studies were screened despite the fact that they were randomized to a non-screened group. And when you look in both studies, that the patients who ended up getting screened, whether they were randomized, in other words, initially told to screen or not screen, if they ended up, we know that people will, quote, drop into a study. They go home, even though they're on the study to not get screened, they go to the doctor checks it. The study investigators can't control that. Those patients who got screened outside the study findings actually did better. They had better outcomes. So when you put together the men that got screened as opposed to the men who were segregated to get screened, that it actually gave only more evidence that screening did have an impact on mortality. So I think the big question here is not, is screening going to be effective at finding cancer or finding serious cancer? It's, was it worth what you underwent? And so indeed, you have to screen a lot of men to find those that would have died. And that's where it becomes difficult or complex. Each man has to decide, am I willing to undergo this knowing that I'm probably going to be fine without it, but I want to minimize my chance of dying of prostate cancer. I'm a good guy to be screened.
Tough decisions for men sitting with that dilemma. Let's go to Hartford, Connecticut, and Robert. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I just thought I'd put some information in for men and physicians. One of the things that has not been talked about yet is what's called PSA velocity, and that's helpful in diagnosing who's developing cancer. It's been hinted at in the sense that the rate at which that PSA test goes up is helpful in diagnosing cancer. The other
Are you a doctor, Robert? Are you
at, yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Medical director of the Preventive Medicine Center in Hartford.
Uh-huh. Very good.
And mothers who have breast cancer are more likely to have sons who will have prostate cancer. In addition, it's also been hinted at about the new imaging techniques. There is what's called 3D imaging. And I think that it's really, I disagree with one of your speakers in the sense that I would want to know because the technology is, I would want to know if I had prostate cancer because the technology is improving so rapidly. It's already been hinted at also, stated, about cryoablation. That's using cold probes mm-hmm. to treat the prostate cancer in location. So if you image, if you diagnose, and then you image by the newer techniques, and then you use these cold probes, we're talking about a vastly reduced discomfort, reduced incidence of impotence, and so on.
That's good information, Robert. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Hadler, what about it? Maybe the treatment technologies are advancing rapidly enough that it'll be more and more useful to know? Are you buying that, Dr. Hadler?
Oh, I am, but show me. That's why we do additional studies, and some of these studies can be done if we will give up on the tiny effect that seems to capture all of America. This notion that I can find one man in 10,000 over the course of 10 years and do something for that one man, that sort of boggles the mind. I can give you a whole bunch of statistical arguments about why that kind of data tends not to reproduce.
But we play the lottery.
Well, that's another point. Whoever, is that you, Tom, that used the lottery? Randomized controlled trials and the lottery have nothing in common. Let me explain that. It is true that we play the lottery, and the argument is somebody's going to win, even though it's incredibly improbable that you're the one.
Yeah.
But randomized controlled trials are different. What they're saying is that if this very improbable event happened, somebody won, they were as likely to win without the intervention as with it. So it's as likely to win a lottery without buying the ticket as with buying it. And that's a very important distinction, because America hears that, gee whiz, you say 1 in 1,000, and the statistical probability came out that that was probably maybe not likely to happen by chance alone, but it's real close. Let me tell you, you're running essentially the same likelihood of winning without the treatment as with it. Mm. So if we move away from small effects and get back to the kind of notion that Dr. Jones and Dr. Andriol were talking about, that we really need a different screening test. We need a test that asks the question, I don't care what kind of test it is, but ask the important questions. Is it an accurate test? Does it find the disease that I care about? If it finds the disease I care about, I will be screened. And if I have the disease I care about and Dr. Jones wants to remove my prostate, I'd rather not die of prostate cancer. It's not an easy way to die. And I would take the chance of incontinence. But when you're giving me that chance with very little likelihood you're saving my life, I personally am not interested.
Well, Don Imus and a lot of other American men listening very closely in the last week and more. Dr. Norton Hadler, author of Worried Sick, thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Hadler.
Thank you.
And Dr. Stephen Jones at the Cleveland Clinic, thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Jones.
Thanks, Tom. This was great work.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.